Welcome to the Kindle Chronicles, the Friday podcast all about your Kindle. I'm Len Edgerly, and this is episode 334 on Friday, December 26th, 2014. Merry day after Christmas. It also happens to be my sister's birthday, December 26th. Happy birthday to Stephanie, and happy holidays from Cambridge, Massachusetts. In this week's episode, you are going to hear from best-selling thriller author Jeffrey Deaver, who is among the first creators of a new form of storytelling, the audible drama, a movie for your ears that has not and probably will not ever be available in printed format on paper or digital reader. He wrote The Starling Project in this format, and it was released last month by Audible.com.
I don't have any issue, how do I put it, aesthetically, with the e-books like some people do. For me, whatever gets people to read is fantastic.
In news, I want to mention a study that I heard about from a good many of you because it purported to warn against reading e-books in bed or at night before you go to sleep. And that's something I do a lot, and I'm sure many of you do as well. Even without reading the details, I was pretty sure the research did not apply to e-ink Kindles, especially ones without the built-in light, because their sleep-stealing qualities would be exactly the same as those of physical books. And as it turns out, the Harvard Medical School study that generated all of the garbled coverage was based on reading iPads, not Paperwhites or Kindle Voyages or other e-readers like the Nook that have the built-in lights and the e-ink screens. Nate Hoffelder, who has a whole category of his excellent blog, The Digital Reader, titled Debunking, nailed it 3 days ago in his post titled, E-readers can disrupt your sleep and other nonsense. He pointed out that even the Jeff Bezos-owned Washington Post missed the context and background details for this story. In an earlier post titled Breaking News, Study Finds Glow from iPads Still Disrupts Sleep, Nate noted that there have been stories for at least the past 4 years which pointed out the connection between using an LCD screen and a negative impact on your sleep pattern. To find them, just Google iPad melatonin, Nate suggested. Without reading research papers, I've known that I don't sleep well when I go directly to bed from my Big Apple Thunderbolt screen working on things on the computer, or I just haven't been tempted to read an iPad, a Fire HDX, or a Fire Phone in bed as I'm trying to fall asleep. They're just too bright. They are, in fact, like staring into a flashlight, which Jeff Bezos has had as his description in the past. I myself prefer reading on a Fire during the day, but at night my Voyage is the way that I wind down, reading some Sherlock Holmes or a book from my inspirational collection. So this was much ado about nothing. Sorry, Harvard. It does show how small the footprint of the e-ink readers has become, I'm afraid, that a research result would be this widely misrepresented as being bad news for e-readers shows that that term, which I think by rights should apply only to dedicated e-readers or e-ink devices, has now morphed into meaning anything flat that you can read on that isn't a physical book. Maybe Amazon should take advantage of the confusion and start using reading in bed as one of the main benefits of the Kindles, along with reading at the beach. First up in Tech Tips, I received an email from Amazon Kindle Support this morning on Friday with the subject Improvements to Kindle Book Samples. This turns out to be a good one because it makes it easier to use samples as a way to tell whether a book is really one that you want to buy. With the improvement announced today, samples that you download from the Kindle Bookstore will now be saved in the cloud so that you can access and read them on any supported Amazon device or Kindle reading app. You can delete your samples from the cloud on any of the supported devices or apps, or you can use the Manage Your Content and Devices page. That's your shortcut for reaching that is amazon.com/mycd, Manage Your Content and Devices. You know, I did receive an email announcing this as if it's the first time. I have some vague sense that this is not new, that maybe they're just sort of emphasizing it to people, and that this may have come to me as a Kindle user as opposed to the media feed that I get that really is obviously real news when it comes. But in any event, it's worth, I think it's good to know that you can do this because it makes samples more convenient to use across your devices. The devices that this works on, there's quite a list. It's the Fire HDX, the Fire HD, the Kindle Fire HDX, that's the older version of the HDX, the Kindle Fire HD 2nd Generation, Kindle Voyage, Kindle Paperwhite 2nd Generation, Kindle 7th Generation, Fire Phone, Kindle for iPhone, iPad, and iPod Touch version 4.5 or greater, and Kindle for Android version 4.7 or greater. Phew. That's quite a list. It's a list that makes the point of how many different platforms are supported by Amazon for Kindle books. It's really a great aspect of the Kindle, especially compared with Apple's iBooks, which you can read only on Apple hardware, if I have that right. You know, I think maybe there's a way probably to read an iBook on your computer, but I haven't had occasion to do that. But in any event, this plethora of devices and apps for Kindles does make answering any particular question about Kindle usage a little challenging because you need to know how someone is reading their Kindle books in order to be of help. With that in mind, I want to share three questions that have come in over the past few weeks at thekindlechronicles.com. That's the show notes page for the podcast, along with my answers. And I'm also going to tell you about one question that came in that I don't know the answer yet to. Lori wrote, while I'm reading a book, is there a way to find out the title? Example, I'm in the middle of Gone Girl and I totally forgot what I'm reading, who the author is. Is there a way to find out? The answer to Lori's question does depend on how you're reading your Kindle book. But for most Kindle devices, Fire tablets, and apps for other hardware, if you bring up the navigation controls, you will see the title of the book at the top of the screen. I've just tried this on my Voyage, and on that e-reader, you tap along the top of the screen to bring up the navigation icons, and then the title of the book appears in white type in a black band at the very top of the screen. On my Fire HD6, the title of the book is always viewable when I'm reading. It shows up in kind of a lighter brown font. I use the sepia setting when I'm reading on the Fire HD, and that's at the top of the reading page. When you tap to bring up the navigation icons, the title disappears. On the Fire Phone, it's the reverse. The title appears at the top when you tap in the book's page to reveal navigation options. Karen asked how to change the page numbering format at the bottom of the page when you were reading a Kindle book. I did it once, she wrote, but can't get back to it. I'd like to have the option to see the page number as corresponds to the actual print page number, or to change from the time left and percentage read or left to read. Again, this depends on the device. For the Voyage, if you tap on the lower left of the screen while you are reading a book, you will see your reading progress by location, physical page number, time left in the chapter, or time left in the book. To change from one view to the next, you simply tap on the lower left corner to cycle through them. If there is no display of where you are, tap anyway. That will bring up the various views. It turns out there's a setting on the menu of the Voyage labeled Reading Progress, and you can set it for none if you don't want to see the location information on that screen while you're reading. You can also set the default for which view appears at the bottom of the page. At the bottom right of the page, you will see your reading progress by percentage completed. The Fire HD6 shows reading progress by physical page number and percentage, but I don't see a way to change that view. Same for the Fire HDX 8.9, the Fire Phone, and the Kindle for iPad app. So this is one of the advantages of the dedicated e-reader, the Kindle Voyage and the Paperwhite. And I believe the same is, I'm pretty sure that same view is available on the Paperwhite. You can see how much time you have left to finish a chapter or a page of your book based on the Kindle's ability to measure how fast you are reading based on a few pages where it watches you read. And this question from Dan Estes, who has moved to a Paperwhite from an earlier Kindle with a physical keyboard. He asked, the go-to page for books displays the table of contents divided into chapters and parts. Sometimes chapters are displayed, sometimes chapters are hidden under parts titles. The parts titles are delineated with arrows pointing to the right or pointing down. Right indicates the chapters are hidden. Down indicates the chapters are displayed. The default condition seems to be chapters hidden, hiding the part titles, i.e. part one, assessing your risk, is an active link. How does one display all of the chapter numbers and titles? Touching on the part title takes you directly to that part of the book since it's an active link. Then if you navigate back to the go-to page, you see the chapter numbers and names. This is a very illogical sequence. I would appreciate any insight you have. The above book is Protein Power by Michael Eads. I purchased Protein Power so I could see the go-to view that Dan refers to, and I see the problem. The book is arranged in three parts, and the only way to see the chapter titles is to tap on the right triangle for each of those three parts. I checked the menu options and settings for reading from the menu of the home screen, and I did not see any way to change this. It's the same on my Fire HD6. I suspect these settings are baked into the formatting of the book by the publisher. I agree with Dan that it's inconvenient not to have a way to see all of the chapters at once, even if they are divided into higher level sections. And now for the question that has me stumped so far. Stacy Harris wrote, somehow, while using my basic Kindle, I moved the percentage read from the bottom right corner to the bottom left. How can this be moved back to the right corner? I thought perhaps Stacy had inadvertently changed the reading progress setting on her Kindle to show the percentage completed at the lower left, but that isn't one of the options on my Voyage. I don't have my basic Kindle with me because it's back in Denver, where Darlene and I will return later tonight after the podcast has uploaded. We're about to make our annual migration west for the winter and spring. So I'll try to remember to check it on my basic Kindle when I get back to our home in Denver. If you know the answer to Stacy's question or you have a question of your own, I hope you'll email me at podchronicles@gmail.com, or you can also leave it as a comment at the show notes page, which is thekindlechronicles.com. Time now for the interview. On his way to becoming a best-selling author, Jeffrey Deaver worked as a journalist, a folk singer, and an attorney. He has written 32 novels, three collections of short stories, and a nonfiction law book. His crime thrillers have been nominated for 7 Edgar Awards by the Mystery Writers of America, and this month he received the prestigious Raymond Chandler Award at the Courmayeur Noir Festival that's held at the foot of Mont Blanc in the Italian Alps. Deaver was born just outside Chicago. He has a Bachelor of Journalism degree from the University of Missouri and a law degree from Fordham. He also has a sister who writes young adult novels. Her name is Julie Reese Deaver, and her titles include The Night I Disappeared and Say Goodnight, Gracie. I reached Jeffrey Deaver on Monday, December 22nd, by Skype and iPhone. I began by asking him for the background story that led to his creation of an audiobook without the book, his Audible drama, The Starling Project.
I am in an organization called the International Thriller Writers, and it was decided, it's a great organization, and it was decided that we're going to look for ways to raise money for the organization to keep fees for membership either non-existent or minimal. So we looked for projects where authors could donate time, presumably writing a thriller novel or short stories or something, sell that, all the proceeds would go to ITW so that the people could join the organization at very low expense to, you know, encourage reading and writing and so forth. Well, one of the projects that they came up with was an original audio serial novel with Audible.com. And the premise was this, that they came to me and said, well, Jeff, would you come up with a concept, a thriller concept, and then you write the first chapter and hand off to another thriller writer, folks like Joe Finder, Lee Child, David Hewson, John Gilstrap, people who were fairly well known in the thriller world. And then they would take what had gone before them, write a chapter that maybe took the story in a different direction, and then it all came back to me, and I wrote the last chapter, trying to kind of reconcile, you know, the curious meanderings of the story. Well, it became a number one bestseller at audible.com. The first one was called The Chopin Manuscript. Did so well, we did a second one that featured the same characters. Well, it was very successful. People enjoyed it. And Audible kept saying, well, Jeff, would you, you know, be interested in doing something on your own with the characters you created? And finally I said, I'm pretty busy. I do at least a book a year and about maybe a dozen short stories. So I don't have a lot of time. But finally I decided, you know, I want to do an original, not just audio book, but an original audio play. And that's how the whole project came about.
Did you have Alfred Molina in mind as you were writing it? He plays Harry Middleton, and I suppose some of the other voices as well, but he's the lead narrator.
Yes, I thought Alfred would be a wonderful choice again, because he had done Harold Middleton in the Chopin Manuscript, and I didn't mention the name of the sequel. It was The Copper Bracelet. Mm-hmm. And he did such a good job. Coincidentally, I didn't have him in mind when I first created the chapter that I wrote for the first and last chapter for the original project for ITW. But he got the role. I don't actually know how that came about, but he got the role and did just a bang-up job of Harry Middleton, because Middleton is a character who is somewhat tormented, very complex, extremely dedicated, a hero for all times. That's what I tried to create, and Alfred really brought that to the table. And so I was just very pleased when he was available to do the longer project, the Starling project.
Well, let's give my listeners a quick look at what's Harold Middleton's challenge in the Starling Project.
Well, if your listeners are familiar with my books at all, I adhere to Mickey Spillane's instruction to writers that the audience does not want a book that's going to take them to the middle of the book and then they're going to put it down. People pick up a book expecting to get to the end of the book as quickly as possible. And I do I'd almost call it a formulaic type thriller, but I mean that in a good sense. Very carefully plotted out, very fast-paced, a story that takes place really over a very short period of time. Well, Harry and the crew on in the Starling Project are originally find themselves in Mexico, and they're trying to track down both an arms dealer and a money launderer who are apparently working for war criminals. Now, Harry is in charge of an organization called the Volunteers. It has a technical name, which isn't really that critical, but they're known as the Volunteers, and they look for war criminals in conflict zones, people who have escaped or may be in power, and their job is to bring them to justice with a fictional international criminal court, sort of like the International Criminal Court for the former Yugoslavia. I kind of based it on that. They find themselves in Mexico at the beginning of the Starling Project, trying to get evidence to issue warrants to arrest a particularly nefarious fellow, and it goes bad. The incident goes bad in a big way, and I don't want to give too much away because so many of my stories depend on surprises, twists and turns, and reversals. And all is not what it seems to be. So from Mexico, the verb I use is slingshot. They slingshot themselves from Mexico back to the D.C. area, then to London, then Prague, the south of France, to Africa, ultimately, with side trips back and forth to London and D.C. again. And what appears to be this nefarious fellow in Mexico, well, it seems that there's a lot more to what's going on. And so we end up, toward the end of the story, well, it appears there's a big surprise. XYZ is, in fact, this mysterious evil starling. Oh no, it's ABC who's the starling. And yet again, two or three more twists and turns.
There's a video that Audible put up showing Molina reading, and it looks like he's in a studio reading a script alone on a tablet, maybe an iPad. Is that how they actually assembled it, that all of the various cast members were recording separately? I had pictured them in my mind as all being in one studio, kind of like old radio drama days.
Yeah, to be honest, Glenn, I'm not familiar with how it was all put together. I'm the kind of writer that, although I've had several movies made of my projects, I finish the writing, and then immediately I'm on to something else. So I did work with them occasionally when they would ask about pronunciation and could we trim a little bit here or there. But I actually don't know how they physically put the whole thing together. I did go to the set of one of my movies once. It was, I was going to say, I think it was A Maiden's Grave, a book of mine from some years ago that James Garner starred in. And I had a fascinating, like, 2 hours on the set. Mm. And after that, I got bored. Because they do you're familiar with this business, of course. They will take 5 minutes from page 37 of the script, and then a half hour after that, they'll do a 10-minute scene from page 85 of the script that, to somebody observing the actual making of the movie, makes no sense whatsoever. The actors and the cast, the cast and the crew, of course, are so professional, they can leap right in and they know exactly what they're doing. But I said, oh, okay, this is fascinating. James Garner was just a very charming, delightful man to meet. And then everybody got down to work, and I went back to the hotel room and started working on a new book because I thought, I just have no idea how they do this. I'm bored. I'm going to go back and get some work done.
That's interesting. There's a part in the opening sequence where your character Davy Davis is dismantling an explosive device, and the script says there's 1 minute and 15 seconds left before it blows up, and I thought, well, this is maybe going to be in real time, so I timed it with a stopwatch, and I found that only 52 seconds elapsed before Lance Corporal Catherine Hughes says the stopwatch is showing zero. I'm not going to give away what happens, but so the audio didn't quite match up with the timing that the script called for, and I thought, well, gee, maybe that was a mistake, but maybe that was it a feature or a bug? Were you thinking that as you wrote something that was going to be heard kind of in what sounds like real time, if you could still condense the time sequence there and it would just make it even more suspenseful?
No, in that case, it was a defective bomb. I think it was made in Russia. I think that was the problem.
I see.
No, I'll tell you that that's a very interesting point. When there were several sequences that I don't know, there were too many of them that were exactly time specific, but I would read the dialogue out loud. I kind of pretended to be a mini actor myself, and to see if the timing worked. And I would actually, it's almost a little embarrassing, I would actually do the sound effects with my voice, because, you know, how long do you fire a machine gun? Well, how long does that go on before it becomes, you know, frankly, kind of silly? And, you know, that when you shift the gears, there's a scene, of course, in the south of France where the two fellows are, they sadly don't get their boulevards. They get a little more than they bargained for. The form of some bad guys chasing them, so they jump on a motorcycle. Well, how long does it take to shift the gear? So I tried to do that. Thank goodness it wasn't recorded, because it would sound very embarrassing, I'm sure, like an amateur high school production of a movie. But I did try to make everything line up there. But of course, there's just so much involved with the production values and some of the equipment and so forth. So I guess that was a particular instance where the bomb was going to go off a little faster than they planned.
Now, you did a story, An Acceptable Sacrifice, was part of the Mysterious Press's Biblio Mysteries series. Your story was in 2012. And there's a great portrait of Alonso Maria Carilla's personal library full of first editions and everything. It was so lovingly portrayed. I wonder, do you have a library that in any way rivals that of the knife?
Oh, I only wish I did. I have some first editions, but only books that are very important to me. I have some books that are first editions, but ones that are important to me. I very much enjoyed Silence of the Lambs, for instance, Thomas Harris's wonderful, you know, one of the truly great serial killing books, and we've had a lot of those, and sometimes they're not too thoughtfully put together, but I was very influenced by Silence of the Lambs. I was just starting to write thrillers at that point, so I managed to get a first edition of that. I have a From Russia with Love. Ian Fleming was, one of my all-time idols. I was, fortunate enough to be picked by the Ian Fleming Estate to write a continuation novel. And some years ago, I was able to pick up a first edition of From Russia with Love. And, I have a John le Carré, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, which is probably my favorite spy book. But I don't have. I have a huge collection. I have a very nice library, but second editions. And I guess this is being recorded, so I guess the collectors will find out. But I have some. They're not necessarily first editions, but they would otherwise be valuable books. But I'll pull it down, and you'll see a post-it note stuck in it, and a margin note to myself that said, "This would be a great idea for a book," or "Listen to this passage. You have to read this passage over again." And I tell some true collectors that, and they're absolutely, absolutely mortified. But for me, books are something that are, I like friends, the things I hang out with. And I don't think they mind a little use other than just being read.
Right. Well, how do e-books figure in your personal reading habits?
I'm somebody who, because of the books primarily, I'm on tour around the world, and I think this year I've flown just on one airline alone about a little over 100,000 miles. So when I travel, I always take my Kindle with me. It's a Kindle app on my iPad. I don't actually have a Kindle itself, I have a bigger smartphone. I've got a couple of phones, and with the advancing years, I thought, I'm not going to be able to read anything on a phone. But, of course, you can up the font size, and it's great. I've got 300-400 books in my pocket, so to speak, so I read them a lot. At home, when I do research, I do tend to use dead tree books more, simply because I need to, stick the post-it notes in, and I'm always flipping back and forth, and I may have to photocopy a page and stick it up in front of me on my bulletin board. But I'm a both person. I'll tell you, when I travel, it's so nice to have every book I need. And I will often get research materials. You can do the tags or copy pages and so forth. I certainly do that. But I just couldn't carry all the books. Maybe in my youth I'd be able to, but I sure can't do it now.
Do you know how many of your proportion of your readers are reading your books generally on Kindles or tablets or other devices these days? It seems like it might be half or more.
Oh, it's more. It's more than half. It's about 60%. In America now, the UK is increasing quite a bit. I can't really tell you the percentage there. Italy, where I sell a great number of books, it's only about 5%, but that's grown very, very quickly from basically non-existent just a few years ago. But in the United States, it's about 60%, and that's fairly stable.
Yeah, it seems like it's kind of reached a plateau.
Yeah, and that's a healthy thing. And I don't have any issue. Aesthetically, with the e-books like some people do. For me, whatever gets people to read is fantastic. And they say, well, it's, oh my gosh, it's just, what's wrong with paper? Wonderful almost iconic items, books up on the shelf. Look at that there. And I said, well, you know, think about that guy in Germany in the date wrong, the 15th century. And he goes into a bar and, hi, how are you doing? Who's that fellow over there? Gutenberg. You know what he did? He invented this thing called a printing press. And it's never going to fly. We've got monks who can do the illuminated manuscripts. We don't need this printing press kind of thing. And, you know, I think, well, you know, that helped everybody. So I think it's great. Anything that gets books into the hands of people, or in the case of audiobooks, into the ears of people, that's good.
Well, speaking of ears, another innovative thing you did with a 2012 book, XO, it's one of your Catherine Dance thrillers, was you launched a companion album containing music for which you had written the lyrics. And I see you've got a new Catherine Dance thriller, Solitude Creek, coming out in May of next year. I'm wondering if there's going to be another album with it.
No, that was a very fun project to do. I used to be a singer-songwriter a long time ago. I was actually never really had the inclination to be a slick performer. I didn't have that kind of talent, but I really enjoyed writing songs. Some of my gods in the music industry were people like Bob Dylan and Jackson Brown, Joni Mitchell, people who were real craftspeople when it came to writing lyrics. And so I thought, well, you know, I don't usually put a lot of myself in the books, but I said, well, you know, maybe it'd be kind of fun to dust off the guitar and write about a half dozen songs, most of which have clues in them. Hmm. And they're standalone songs. I mean, you can listen to them as country western songs, but they kind of inform the one of the characters in the book, Kaylee Towne, sort of a Taylor Swift kind of young crossover artist. And if you listen to the songs, they kind of explain things about her life, and then some of the songs describe places that may be important in the crimes that occur in the book, XO. And so I thought, well, let me see if I can do that. And I just had great fun. It was just really enjoyable to do. And I can't say I'm going to retire on the royalty income, although I don't know that many artists now can retire on the royalty income from music. It's kind of a different world than it used to be when I got started, and it was about 30 or 40 years ago. So that was fun to do. But no, Solitude Creek is just about a sick and twisted killer. There's no music involved.
Now, I see that at least the recent books have been published by Hachette, and Amazon and Hachette agreed on a new contract last month. I noticed that in the previous showdown between Macmillan and Amazon nearly 5 years ago, the two companies had funded a joint fund, I think it was several million dollars, which Macmillan distributed to authors as compensation for their losses during that dispute. And I haven't seen, it seemed like at one point Amazon suggested something like that, but after the contract was signed, I haven't seen any mention of it. And you may not be able to say if you have heard, but have you heard of any possibility that there's going to be a similar fund that will compensate authors that were really financially harmed during that contract dispute?
Yeah, I have not heard anything about that.
Hmm. Do you have a sense of how much lost royalties you experienced because of it?
I would guess it was significant. Now, as it turned out, because I am fairly new to Hachette, and you know how the publishing business works, of course, they pay in advance that over X number of years or months is earned back, you know, the accounting period. But I lost a lot of the income that would, well, I should say I lost a lot of the revenue that would go against that advance. Now, at this point, we're just doing the kind of year-end financial stuff, so I couldn't tell you how much that was. But I do know that the books weren't on the bestseller list as long as they would have been, and I heard from I heard from folks that said, "Oh, you know, Jeff, I just want to buy your book, but the 28th, I think it was discounted some, but it wasn't the full discount." But that's, you know, $10, $8, $10. That's a lot of money. They'll wait for the paperback to come out, or they'll get the ebook, which is, of course, has a lower price point. But they wanted the hardcover, and they said that's just not financially viable now. That's, you know, there's a lot of money. The economy's getting better now, but it's still kind of tough for people. But you know, we're certainly glad that got resolved.
Yeah. Now, you were one of the authors that signed the Authors Unlimited letter urging Amazon to resolve the dispute. Was that a tough thing to decide to join that group that was, you know, pretty much siding against Amazon when it's clear you'd had some successful collaboration with Amazon's Audible subsidiary on projects like the Starling project?
There was not a moment of hesitation. My position was always that the dispute between Hachette, in this case, or any publisher, and a major retailer, that's between them. You know, Jeff Bezos and Michael Peach, they can work out whatever the arrangement is. And that's, you know, that's fine. My problem, though, was the, you know, the approach of the delayed deliveries, the reduction of the discount, and then the pop-up ads suggesting that you might, on my page, for instance, that you might like, instead of Deaver, another author who wrote a similar book for the full discount. And my concern about that was, you know, it wasn't going to end my career, but it, you know, I thought it could really interfere with the careers of some beginning authors, new authors, and who really require that leg up. It's a different publishing world now. I don't know how long you've been in, you know, writing about the subject, but it, you know, when I started, there were probably 14, 15 good-sized publishers, and it was kind of easier to find a home then. And now, you know, there are fewer publishers. I think there's many or more books being published now, but it's just harder to get into. And so that's what that was what most of us objected to, or at least that's what I had some problems with.
You received a pretty prestigious award 2 weeks ago, the Raymond Chandler Lifetime Achievement Award at the Courmayeur Noir Festival in Italy. And it said you recited some Latin and said that you'd begun writing your latest work, which will be set in Italy. Can you say any more about that writing project?
Sure. It actually it's not going to be my next book. It's a book I am working on at the moment, but because it is set in a foreign country, a venue that I'm quite familiar with. I've spent a long time in Italy. I've been traveling there for many years. I'm pretty comfortable about the area. But just as with my book Garden of Beasts, which was set in Germany in the 1930s, that took about 2 years to research. So the outline for this book is done. I don't have a title for it yet. I'll have to work with my Italian publisher on that, because some titles work in, you know, foreign countries and others don't. I'll give you just a fast example on that one. My latest book in America from Hachette is The Skin Collector, which is a sequel to The Bone Collector.
Right.
And in Italy, the title was, I think rather cleverly, In the Shadow of the Collector. Because Skin Collector there has I guess it's sort of the same connotation it has here, but it had more of a lascivious side to it, a connotation, something I never would have thought of. It's about a psychotic tattoo artist. And so I thought Skin Collector, oh, Bone Collector, it's rather clever, and it certainly worked in English. But I will be working closely with my Italian publisher, Rizzoli, on that, although, of course, the book will be published here as well. And that was kind of fun. I was trying to think of something. I think I mentioned that. I don't know if you saw the remarks, but John Grisham, who's a, you know, wonderful writer, the master of the thriller, he had given his acceptance for the same award in Italian, and my Italian is, you know, I'll go there quite a bit. My Italian is rather marginal at best. I thought, oh, gee, I'd like to thank them in something that was, in some form that was rather meaningful. And I thought, oh, well, 4 years of Latin, of course, Professor Corso. You know, he drummed it into my head and said, you got to do something with this, Jeff. And so I thought that was kind of cute. And I was very surprised who was in the audience there, but a Latin professor. And uh-huh. He came up to me and said, I approve of your pronunciation. So
that's pretty good. I think in the Acceptable Sacrifices comment about which books a character reads to lull themselves to sleep, and given that you're writing books for a living and totally in the world, do you have any books that you reliably turn to when you're trying to lull yourself to sleep at night?
Well, I'll tell you what I read a lot of. I really enjoy nonfiction quite a bit. And putting it this way makes it sound like the author didn't do a very good job, but before I fall asleep, I'll pick up a history book. The one I'm reading right now is Barbara Tuchman's The Guns of August. And, you know, it's the whole canvas of the First World War, the beginning of the First World War, which doesn't really sound like a book that's going to put you immediately to sleep, but I just, I find that if I read fiction at night, I start getting ideas, and I'll either say, you know, in fairness, I would have done that scene differently. That just doesn't work. What's the author thinking of? Or I'll read something and say, boy, that just really irritates me because it's such a brilliant scene and such a superb twist. Then I won't fall asleep because I'll be thinking, gosh, I wish I could have done that, and I'll never be as good a writer as this person. So, and then the one I'm going to reread is Mornings on Horseback, the Teddy Roosevelt book by David McCulloch, which was I read years ago and was fantastic. So I kind of like returning to the it's just good solid prose.
Yeah, there's something restful about it. I have a similar effect when I read Sherlock Holmes for some reason, that totally rational view. But for you, there'd be more springboard to ideas if you were reading too much Holmes at night, probably.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And one thing I'd like to get back into is horror. I haven't read Stephen King for some time. He's a phenomenon like nothing else. Superb writer. In 100 years, when people have forgotten all about Jeffrey Deaver, Stephen King will still be being talked about, I'm sure.
Well, I think there's going to be a lot of people talking about your work for a long time, particularly the innovative aspect of it. I love how you've played with the form in this latest thing with Audible, and seems like you have some restless creativity that is probably going to be surprising people for years.
Well, I did the a book a couple of years ago that I knew was not going to be it actually was a bestseller in most countries, but in most countries where it was published, but that was a bit of a surprise to me. It was called The October List, and it goes backwards. You open the book to page one, which is chapter 36, the last chapter, and you read backwards in time over the course of about 2 days, and it was something that I was inspired by Stephen Sondheim's musical, Merrily We Roll Along, which goes backwards in the same way. And I thought, well, could I write a thriller like that? I mean, it seems, I wasn't sure I could do it. So with all my books, I do an outline, rather extensive. I think in that case, it was about a 60, 70-page outline. And it, the outline worked out. I thought, well, okay, I'll try it. And it did well. And I just wanted to add, as you suggested a moment ago, to the body of work. You know, whether I'm not going to create a genre of backward-going thrillers, but it was fun to try.
I have been speaking with Jeffrey Deaver, author of The Starling Project and Audible Drama, and more than 30 other books, including The Skin Collector, his latest Lincoln Rhyme novel. Thanks very much, Jeff.
Well, a pleasure talking to you now.
in content, I'll have a list of Jeffrey Deaver's books in the show notes. And I want to mention another book, The Martian, a novel by Andy Weir. I heard about it at Booktopia Boulder in May, and I keep hearing about it lately, most recently from listener Jeff Culverhouse, who noted that The Martian was originally self-published in 2012, then re-released by Crown in 2014. That's it for this week. I have two interviews scheduled next week. I'm not sure yet which order I will release them on the podcast. One is Greg Lavoy, author of Vital Signs, The Nature and Nurture of Passion, a big and compelling new book, which was released today, December 26th. The other is John Ashbery, one of America's foremost living poets, whose poetry has recently been published in line break friendly ebook format by Open Road Media. This is Len Edgerly in Cambridge, Massachusetts for the Kindle Chronicles. I really appreciate your taking the time to listen to my podcast. Have a great day and a happy new year.